First of all, good evening. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Disidentification, Race, Sexuality, and Contemporary Art, a panel discussion in conjunction with the current exhibition, Glenn Ligon, America, which has come to the Modern from the Whitney Museum of Art, thanks in good part to the efforts of our curator, Andrea Carnes. So if we could just thank you, Andrea. I did that in part to embarrass Andrea, and also because I don't think she's gotten enough credit. This actually was not scheduled to come here, and it's been such an enormous hit, and I personally am so thankful for it being here. And she sort of went to bat for it, so I think she deserves that round of applause. We are also honored to have with us tonight a distinguished panel of scholars from various fields and art disciplines to engage us all in issues of ideas, issues and ideas of identity as found in the 1996 book Disidentification, Queers of Color, and the Performance of Politics, which is by one of our panelists, Jose Esteban Munoz. It is, of course, related to those issues as observed and experienced in Glenn Ligon, America. Our moderator for tonight's panel is writer, curator, and artist Noah Semblist. Noah received a BA and an MA from Hampshire College in Amherst and an MFA from the University of Washington in Seattle. He is an associate professor of art at SMU, and he is probably familiar to most of you, as he is to Texas art community at large, thanks to his tireless and sometimes supernatural involvement and presence through writing, curating, showing, teaching, and instigating in almost every corner of the state. You would be hard-pressed to find anyone involved in art in Texas who doesn't know who Noah Semblist is. For that matter, across the country, in many parts of the Middle East and in Europe, Noah quietly inserts himself in the activities and discourses that he is passionate about, and he is passionate about so much. His current research focuses on the relationship between contemporary art and politics regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a topic he has explored in his own work as an artist, has identified through personal activism, is pursuing in his doctoral studies at the University of Texas, has represented curatorially with exhibitions such as Out of Place at the Laura Reynolds Gallery in Austin, and it has been recognized for with fellowships and awards such as the 2012 Critic in Residency at the Israeli Center of Digital Art in Holon, Israel, and his acceptance in the 2011 Artiste Curatorial Program in Israel. As a PhD student at UT, Noah was the 2010-2011 Curatorial Fellow at the University's Visual Arts Center, where he co-curated with David Wilburn Queer States, an exhibition that received a great deal of critical acclaim, and which, along with a related symposium which Noah organized for the exhibition, as well as his valuable role in a panel titled Inflammatory Images and the Politics of Sex at Art House in Austin earlier last year, prior to the exhibition Queer States. It was because of these that exhibition and then also those panels, or the symposium and the panel, that I was prompted to ask Noah's advice on tonight's panel and his involvement as the moderator. This is, I have to say, a meager introduction, given all that Noah is and has done, but tonight's topic is very demanding and our time is short. So from here, I'm going to turn it over to Noah, and he is going to give you the particulars and the layout of tonight's program, as well as introduce his fellow panelists, who we are so fortunate to have here and of whom I am so appreciative for being involved. So if you would, please join me in welcoming everybody, and then I'll turn it over to Noah.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you all for being here. So I'm going to keep my introductory remarks relatively brief in the beginning. So essentially, I'm going to function primarily as a moderator. And we have these four distinguished panelists who will be giving brief introductions to the topic that we're going to be discussing, and then we're going to have some time to discuss amongst ourselves and then to discuss together with you. So that's the structure. The subject matter is multivalent. We're here basically, as Terry mentioned, in relationship to the Glenn Ligon show, but as Glenn Ligon's show demonstrates in a lot of ways, identity is something that is raised by his work, but at the same time it's complicated in many ways. And so Terry and I had thought that Jose Esteban Muñoz's book, Disidentifications, would be a great way to sort of start to unpack maybe the first thing that we might assume his work to be about, which is identity. So what I'm going to do is just introduce everyone in their order of speaking so that we can get that out of the way and then get on to some real conversation. Actually, one thing that I wanted to say at first was we're just acknowledging that today is May Day. And has been a day of strike for many people. So as cultural workers, we are working today, but but we are acknowledging that there are others who are not for good reason. Okay, so I'm going to start with Jose. Jose Esteban Muñoz is professor of performance studies and chair of the department of NYU's Tisch School of Art. His work focuses on visual culture, queer theory, cultural studies, and critical theory. The book that we'll be discussing today in relationship to Glenn Ligon's work is Disidentifications, Queers of Color and the Performance of Politics, which was published in 1999. And it examines queer and racial minority issues from a performance studies perspective. His second book, Cruising Utopia, The Then and There of Queer Futurity, was published by NYU Press in 2009. He also has co-edited Pop Out, Queer Warhol with Jennifer Doyle and Jonathan Flatley, and Every Night Life, Culture and Dance in Latino America with Celeste Fraser Delgado. Muñoz was born in Havana, Cuba, shortly before relocating with his parents to Florida. He received his undergraduate education at Sarah Lawrence and his doctorate from the graduate program in literature at Duke, where he worked with queer theorist Eve Kozofsky Sedgwick. He's written about artists, performers, and cultural figures, including Vaginal Davis, Nao Bustamante, Carmelita Tropicana, Isaac Julian, Kevin Aviance, James Schuyler, and Andy Warhol. So then, to the right, just so that we can get all the intros done with, is Annette Lawrence, who is a visual artist based in Texas since 1990. Her work is generally related to text and information, often in response to physical space and time. Lawrence's work has been widely exhibited and is held in museums and private collections, including the Museum of Fine Arts Houston, the Dallas Museum of Art, the Rachofsky Collection, Art Pace Center for Contemporary Art, the Blanton Museum in Austin, and American Airlines, and her work was included in the 1997 Whitney Biennial. Recent accomplishments include a commission for a large-scale permanent installation entitled Coin Toss at the new Cowboys Stadium in Arlington, and received the Dozier Travel Award from the Dallas Museum of Art for travel to Australia. Lawrence has participated as an artist-in-residence programs in Houston, Skowhegan, Maine, Johannesburg, South Africa, in Scotland, in Melbourne, and she's taught as a visiting artist at American University at the Yale School of Art. Lawrence grew up in Queens and Freeport, New York. She received a BFA from the Hartford Art School and an MFA from MICA. Lawrence currently lives and works in Denton and is professor of drawing and painting at the University of North Texas. And then, to her right. Oof. This makes is like many Tuesday evenings all in one. Next to her is Rose Pulliam, who works as a co-director of ALGO, a statewide queer people of color organization in Texas. She was formerly the president of the National Domestic Violence Hotline and executive director for the Vermont Network Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the Domestic and Sexual Assault Coalition for Vermont. Rose has served as the Associate Director of the Alabama Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Executive Director of the Family Service Center of Talladega, and the Executive Director of Second Chance, Inc., a local domestic violence program in Alabama. Her experience includes advocacy and policy work on issues including child abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence, and perpetrator intervention program implementation. Rose's programmatic background includes clinical and advocacy work with adolescents and a 7-year stint as healthcare administrator. Rose holds a Bachelor of Science in Psychology and a Master's in Social Work, both from the University of Alabama. In addition to her activism work, Rose Pulliam, a second-year doctoral student at the University of Texas School of Social Work, is the recipient of the Louis E. DeMaul Endowed Presidential Scholarship. Rose utilized her research skills that she acquired thus far in her doctoral studies conducting research related to HIV/AIDS in Ghana this past summer. When she's not learning about or working on serious issues, Rose loves to laugh and sometimes perform stand-up comedy. finally, Roberto Tejada is professor of art history at SMU. His research and teaching methods interrogate modern and contemporary image environments from an interdisciplinary viewpoint, a critical art history whose visual knowledge can locate objects and actors in the global culture context. He's the author of National Camera, Photography, and Mexico's Image Environment, and Celia Alvarez Munoz. He has served as co-curator on the exhibitions Manuel Alvarez Bravo Optical Parabels at the J. Paul Getty Museum and Luis Gisper Loud Image at the Hood Museum of Dartmouth College. His research has earned awards from the Creative Capital Warhol Foundation and from the NEA. He received his PhD from SUNY Buffalo and has taught at the National Autonomous University of Mexico at Dartmouth College, where he was the Cesar Chavez Fellow at the University of California, San Diego, and the University of Texas, Austin. His writings appear frequently in exhibition catalogs, and he has published critical writings in contemporary U.S., Latino, and Latin American artists in Afterimage, Aperture, Bomb, The Brooklyn Rail, SF Camera Work, and Third Text. Tejada also lived in Mexico City, where he has worked as an editor of Vuelta magazine, published by the late Nobel laureate Octavio Paz, and as executive editor of Artes de Mexico. Tejada is as well the author of several poetry collections, including Mirrors for Gold and Exposition Park. He founded and continues to co-edit the journal Mandorla, New Writing in the Americas. So that is our panel. Let's begin with Jose. Okay.
I'm going to take the podium because I've been asked to give a 15-minute introduction to my term disidentification and to talk about Glenn Ligon's work. So it's a little more kind of formal, and I'm better at the podium. When I sit down and read, I get a little sleepy. more up at the podium. So if you don't mind me standing behind you, fellow panelists, colleagues, I'm back here, okay? And so I'm really happy to be here. Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, everyone at the museum who's made this possible. I'm super happy for this opportunity to revisit some work of mine that I did a while ago, and to also ruminate a little on Glenn Ligon's work that I've been interested in but haven't had a chance to write about for a long time. So I'm going to just start by going over what I meant by this term disidentification. We all know ourselves through the rich pleasure of identifying with something outside of us. We can identify with other people, of course. In them, we see something of ourselves. We also identify with objects in popular culture or media, or the kind of objects we encounter in the museum space. In the luster of objects that we deem like us, we find a path to attachment and belonging to something bigger and outside ourselves. Identification appeases us. It holds us in the world, letting us feel less alone, less isolated. It cuts and interrupts the alienation that is implicit, endemic in the human condition. We don't only identify with people and objects, we also find solace and comfort in a style of living or being in the world that represents who we think we are or want to be. We also find the same possibilities in the realm of emotions. We know what it is to feel alike, to be like-minded, and to like the same things. Our identifications ground us in the world, and to be in the world is to identify. But this is the positive side of things. There's also its opposite, the not finding ourselves in people and objects, the failure to perceive our likeness, and subsequently not liking things. This is identification's negative side, wherein which we know ourselves by what we are not like. Some of us cohere with one another through not identifying in unison. Sometimes we define ourselves as those who feel differently. Many think the difference in the world between people and things should be a value. I think probably most of us think the difference in the world should be a value. Something to be desired or desirable, but unfortunately it's often not taken as a value. Some of us identify with one constellation of people and objects. A process is often reciprocal insofar as the objects and people identify right back with you, or at least with the desire to be like them or like them. This could be just fine, the fact that people identify with some things and against others. The failure to value or love difference would not necessarily have so many dire consequences, but this is not the case because of the nature of value itself. The world is structured around violent inequalities that we experience as value and devaluation. Some forms of life, even within the category of the human, are valued over others. Some people, because of who they are, where they are from, what they look like, what they act like, are routinely devalued. We know that some lives are allotted greater value in the world by governments, institutions, and other systemic forces like capitalism. Folks who do not have access to money, people whose race, sexuality, gender, ability, citizen status, appearance, and age, and other variables deviate from a public and national norm often get the short end of the stick, and they are often blocked from access to the resources that are necessary for a sustainable life. I've discussed the welcoming and collectivizing experience of identification and its other, a kind of not identifying that I call counter-identification. In my book, Disidentification, Queers of Color, and the Performance of Politics, I work through a third term that was not identification or its other, counter-identification. One misreading I have encountered of my text was the idea that the dis in disidentification meant a simple dissing, a dismissal, a disrespect towards identification. Instead, I meant to describe a disidentification that was not a simple acceptance or rejection of a person, an object, a form, a way of being in the world, etc. Instead, I wanted to tell another story about those of us who feel differently, look differently, and act differently, think differently from a mythical norm, and yet manage to carve out a sustainable life despite these odds against us. We do so by working on with and against dominant forms. And that's at the center of my thinking about disidentification, is the way in which, rather than identifying with some things or simply rejecting them, we often work on them, through them and against them simultaneously, and rework them. This something is done by almost anyone who doesn't feel held by the mythical norm. Disidentification is a survival strategy in which we actively find a way to identify with stories, images, objects that deny the specificity of our experience or actively interrupt or undermine it. Here I'm referring to the way in which we find a way to feel held in a world that is not too attuned to our which is not attuned to our particularity and often hostile to it. We do this by writing our own stories, painting our own pictures, making our own movies. More of this happens every day and it's of optimal importance that we endeavor in making work that speaks to our particularities that make up a larger plurality. But we also make symbolic and real space for ourselves in the world by engaging the dominant script and rewriting it to be with, for, and about us in ways that matter. Disidentification's trajectory commences with mere survival, but it often leads to an actual flourishing. Everyday people do this, but this process is often illuminated for us by the work of art. Art, the aesthetic, offers us blueprints on how to live differently, how to feel more compassionately, and how to think differently. In the glow of the artwork, we encounter a flight plan for a constant process of becoming that is never fixed, always dynamic. When interviewed by the Parisian gay press on the question of the then-emerging gay liberation movement in Paris, the philosopher Michel Foucault proclaimed that the point is not to be homosexual, but to always be engaged in a process of becoming. As he put it, to reinvent the world from A to Z. This idea from Foucault has been inspirational to my own writing, and it certainly influenced my effort to describe a process called disidentification. When I wrote Disidentification, Glenn Ligon's work was not one of my examples. I was familiar with the artist at the time, but did not have a chance to fully contemplate his work. The invitation to speak with you all tonight has afforded me an opportunity to think about Ligon's work in relationship to my initial work on disidentification and my current thinking about art and the term queer of color that my first book theorized. Queer of color is a term that's meant to collect and mobilize many people who experience a simultaneous disalignment with the norm in relationship to both sexuality and race. Ligon's trajectory from a young abstract painter to that of a groundbreaking multimedia artist has been carefully described in many places, most comprehensively in the America catalog. In the remainder of my talk today, I want to focus on Ligon's contribution to this formation that I am referring to as queer of color artistic production. I'll describe the work through the lens of disidentification. I was tempted to spiral out and call attention to the work of younger artists whose practice I find similarly compelling, but instead I decided to stick to Ligon's work because I think its strange elegance and sharp wit commands even more attention than it has already received. It was at first difficult to recognize Malcolm X in this silkscreen image, silkscreen and painting. In the context of the America show, I was drawn to it after spending time with the imposing text of his paint quotations. And this is all on that second floor. If you haven't seen it, run to it. It's very, very interesting, and these slides don't do it justice. So I was, mostly wrangling with the very dense text stuff. And then I ran into these images. The text, had literary sources like James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, Zora Neale Hurston. But in this image of Malcolm X, I found an exuberance of color that arrested me. Once I recognized the face as that of the iconic murdered civil rights leader, I felt some discomfort. I asked myself, was this work having too much fun with an icon whose insurrectionist stance still mattered to so many? Soon I understand the project's parameters, how the artist had given coloring book pages from 60s and 70s coloring books targeted to the African-American community to a group of contemporary, ethnically diverse children in a piece commissioned by the Walker Art Center in Minnesota. This is 2000. I quickly did the math and figured out that these are the kinds of coloring books Ligon would have probably encountered as a child in the 1960s Bronx. Ligon did kind of adaptions, silkscreen painting adaptions, of some of the pages he had collected from the children. In the subsequent prints in the series, we encounter a child at play on a tire. His face is both black and orange, and his swinging tire is purple and blue, black, and it hangs from a multi-hued tree as a white dog looks on. The image is kinetic. It reminds us of the fantasies of unrestricted mobility that characterize childhood play. In other canvases, we see the image of a proud, young African-American graduate in cap and gown. Her features are distorted by a swarm of red that conceals her face and bleeds into the blueness of her cap and the strange pink-purplish aura that surrounds her. The image is not realist, but the exuberance of colors still connotes a dizzying sense of accomplishment without following a realist color schema. Another page showcases the letter S in relationship to the 1970s rendition of A Black Life World. S is for soul, and the thick F is colored with mismatching stripes, and its lowercase companion is a beautiful maroon. A bright yellow sun pulsates in the middle of the page, and a black woman with literal black skin and an orange afro hovers overhead and seems to smile. Next to her, the word shade is crossed out, along with the word six and sun elsewhere on the page. And we can imagine that this page is a homage to the brightness that sometimes accompanies a child's perspective. An intense jet black tangle of lines functions as an aura surrounding Frederick Douglass. He seems to be radiating an ineffable blackness. Finally, Harriet Tubman is surrounded by something that appears to be an expansive aura that is simultaneously a rainbow and the plumage of a peacock. Here, like in most of the series, color intoxicates. It overwhelms the people in her background who are barely visible. Certainly, this coloring with different mismatched colors, almost always coloring outside the lines, looks like the process of disidentification that children who feel different and are different discover early on. In some cases, they do not know what the world is supposed to be, so they do as they please. And in other cases, they have encountered enough of life to want something else and wish it into being through aesthetic experimentation. Either way, when reinterpreted by Ligon and turned into proper art objects, they give insight into this process of thinking and doing something else, what I call participating in a practice of otherwiseness, which is the process of constructing another world using a different kind of wisdom or knowledge than that which is upheld by the mythical norm. Disidentification is a mode of thinking and doing otherwise, and it's something most queer kids must learn to do from a very early age, since their lives often depend on it. This is not to say that Ligon's source material is the work of queer children, but is to say that Ligon's work shows us that there is something very queer about childhood itself, the moment in life before normativity bears down on us. The rich color field that we can associate with the 60s and 70s also pulsates from the canvas of many of Ligon's text paintings of Richard Pryor jokes. In these canvases, Ligon mines the humor of Richard Pryor to talk about a weird and mutable world of black masculinity. And so this is a famous line of Pryor's. And Ligon, keeps on coming back to Pryor over the course of years. He also narrates, so in this one, it's about the weird and mutable world of black masculinity. He also narrates the collision of sensibilities between the world and of emerging black is beautiful vibe and the stagnant world of parents who respond to the utopian impulse of these sentiments with cynicism. And that would be this. Right, they all end with the same line. In the final image, we see a familiar joke about purportedly straight men who have sex with gay men or faggots, as the text indicates, and suffer shame because of their partner's indiscretion. This much can be said about the formal. There is much that can be said about the formal qualities of these images, the strange effect that Ligon's typography achieves. But for now, I'll just remark on the fact that humor is often a mode in which disidentification is practiced. As Freud teaches us, jokes work because they interrupt our perception of reality and suggest an alternative world. The philosopher Paulo Virno suggests that within the joke, we can find a new diagram for living. For me, disidentification is this diagramming of new ways of living. Finally, I want to show Ligon's most famous example of what I would call disidentification. His response to Robert Mapplethorpe's famous Black Book, Notes in the Margin of the Black Book. In this series, Ligon uses the voice of theorists, and I don't have a detail for this. Maybe you'll have a detail later, Noah?
We couldn't find one either, so this is about the close we're going
to get. Okay, so this is kind of a detail. But so, as you see, like, this is the famous Black Book, the very controversial Black Book. And the text in the between the photographs, between the rows of photographs, are the voices of theorists, colleagues, right-wing zealots, people he met at bars, all talking about Mapplethorpe's images. It's too easy to read this piece as a full-on refusal or denunciation of the older artist, right? We can just say this is saying, you know, Mapplethorpe is bad, Mapplethorpe is awful. But instead, he shows us what the theorist Jacques Rancière would call dissensus, or disagreement, as the productive condition of possibility for political collectivity. I would suggest that the dis and disidentification is quite resonant with the dis of dissensus. Ligon disidentifies with the Black Book, which is to indicate that he does not simply write in the book's margins, but he projects these notes out, and he performs them like a score to a piece of discordant but altogether engaging music. In hopes of extending the conversation, I will end on this note, and hopefully we can talk more. Great, thanks.
Thanks. So Annette, you're going to...
So, whoa. Oh, that's what you meant by going.
Yeah.
Did you hear any of that? Would I just start over? Okay.
Yeah.
So in preparing for this talk, I was thinking about Glenn Ligon's work in terms of how he uses quotations, and also just thinking myself about how I've collected them over the years, and a presentation that I went to on Thursday of last week by Alexis Pauline Gums, where her whole presentation was predicated on quotations that she keeps with her at all times by black feminists, that she sort of, it's her heritage, her intellectual heritage. So I went into my own archive, and I made an audio recording of James Baldwin from his documentary film called James Baldwin, The Price of the Ticket. It's a film that was out in, when was it? It was made in 1990, directed by Karen Thornton, and it's available on DVD now at California Newsreel, which is the distributor that distributed the film. Since Glenn uses James Baldwin's quotes, I just thought I would bring his voice in the room. So, not yet, not yet.
to tease.
I'm gonna set up all of the quotes because it just runs on one CD. So the first one is James Baldwin. The next is Alexis Pauline Gumbs. I taped her talk on Thursday, and I was able to edit down just a few minutes of it. But Alexis is a self-described queer black feminist troublemaker. And if you haven't heard about her yet, you will soon. She's actually one of the listed on one of 40 under 40 in this month's Advocate. And she's lighting the world on fire. So one of the quotes is, "Jimmy loves Angela," and the other is about Sapphire. So I'm bringing her voice in the room, and she's bringing their voices in the room. And the last quote on the CD you'll hear is June Jordan, and I sampled it from the film A Place of Rage, which is by Pratima Parmar in 1991, and it's coming on DVD soon. It appears to be available for free to view online if anybody wants to see it immediately. You might after you hear this quote. Okay, let's roll it.
What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You've always told me it takes time. It's taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress?
This one is also about that love. This is what James Baldwin wrote to Angela Davis in an open letter when she was in prison. If we know, so November 19, 1970, if we know, then we must fight for your life as though it were our own, which it is. For if they take you in the morning, they will be coming for us that night. Therefore, peace. Peace. This hashtag Jimmy loves Angela, and therefore peace. So Sapphire, in a book called Meditations on the Rainbow, which is written by Sapphire, better known as the author of Push. She wrote this book in 1987, and neither Tyler Perry nor Oprah would ever support it being made into a film because, for example, she says, this is a good one to end with. We stand in lavender. The fierce society demand. We hide lavender rebellion. Homosexual persuasion. Homosexual. There it is. That divine feared word. Love your own.
If you were to omit from the American left, all the gay and lesbian peoples that there are, you wouldn't have any left. I'm telling you right now, you would have no left. And what I'm talking about is like reciprocation here, reciprocity. And beyond that, I think what people have to understand is that freedom cannot be qualified. It cannot. If we're talking about freedom, we're talking about freedom. Every sphere of your life, and certainly the sphere of your heart, should not be something relegated to a peripheral issue. My heart is not peripheral to me.
So in the interest of time, I just want to say that again, that was James Baldwin, Alexis Pauline Gumbs, and June Jordan. And we might listen to it again maybe later.
Sure.
And it's my first attempt at making a sound piece. So some of the noise, is just in the recording. But and the James Baldwin and the June Jordan pieces were taped from a boombox, which were and the cassette that I was recording was taped from a video playing on a television. So I cleaned it up a lot, even though it's still a mess. Anyhow, okay, it's all you.
Oh. Okay. I'm sitting here with artists and art scholars, and in a way, I am a part of the process of your disidentification, because I have the opportunity, and depending on how you decide to look at me, perhaps shake up their notions of what it means to be an artist or a scholar, to shake up my notions of what it means to be an artist and a scholar, and to shake up your notions of what it means to be an artist and a scholar. My work is at ALGO, which is a statewide queer people of color organization here in Texas. It's located in Austin. And at ALGO, cultural arts of all kinds are integral to the work of social change and community building that we do there. In my mind, this notion of disidentification is important and really connects to the work that ALGO does, in that it's my belief that there is so much that we cannot allow ourselves to see and to know, that identification, that who we are, what we are, how we live in the world, that everything outside of that is outside of our vision to some degree, and that art is a mechanism for shaking that out and having you turn your head just enough to see that which is not ordinarily seeable to us. And Ligon's work is very effective at helping us to see that which is outside of our peripheral vision. The other part of that is that it's really important for queer people of color to see their likeness and the examples of their likeness around them. And one of the ways that it's possible for that to happen is in the production of art. We get to see ourselves, and we get to see how we aspire ourselves to be. We also get to see notions of what ourselves could be, how we might reconstruct and reconstitute ourselves to become. And so art becomes a very active way of creating ourselves, but also creating our communities and imagining what our communities can be. We know that race is a totally fabricated concept, not biological. It doesn't really exist, except that it does. We know, right? We know that gender, in large part, is a totally fabricated concept. This concept of male and femaleness looks very different depending on culture and setting and even locality, even within the U.S. So we make that stuff up, too. I almost said something else there. And this notion of sex in terms of biological sex, this bifurcation, is also pretty made up. It is not that clean, even in the biological sense, this male and female. So this opportunity to experiment and really to expose this fabrication is very much what Ligon's art is able to do. So there are ways in which it's that disidentification, but it's also this exposure of this falsehood that the normal has created and perpetrated. ALGO is by, for, and about queer people of color. And so in our arts work, we create that opportunity for folks to experience themselves within and without, outside of their own identities. And art is wonderful, a wonderful way to do that because it appears benign. It's inobtrusive. Generally, you go see it. And so it feels incredibly safe. So it's not somebody, you know, turning your head to make you see something outside. It's you willingly moving to expose yourself to something that then shakes up your world, messes with you in a way that you have to reconstitute yourself. And so what's beautiful about that is that both the production serves to do that shaking up. So in the creation of art, both the artist and those people who have an opportunity to experience the art are shaken up in that way, and that art becomes an artifact because it really is an expression of what was at a particular time, because in the making of it, things become different. And so it's both that artifact and that production, but it also is this instigator and initiator, which makes it a wonderful tool to use in social change, community building, and cultural change. And although we've had a really wonderful opportunity to work with amazing queer people of color artists of all genres, some of them include Adelina Anthony, who is this vicious Chicana who really shakes up notions of what it means to be a queer Chicana. Sharon Bridgeforth with her Love Conjure Blues. Some of you may have heard some of these names. Shea Youngblood, who as an artist in residence at ALGO, helped folks to think about themselves as artists and what that means and how that shakes them up. Marvin K. White, Karen Sanders, and many others. They do the same thing that Ligon does in his work. And it's sometimes they are, as queer artists, queer people of color artists, their work isn't obviously queer in when you think about gender and sexuality. And in many cases, it situates itself in a racial domain. But even when it does that, it's queer. And it shakes up the perception of both what a queer artist can be and who is. So it's not the white queer, it's queer people of color. And it allows these artists to be who they are, when they are, you know, and where they are. And then queerly queer art doesn't have to have a people of color perspective in order to shake up that whole dynamic. And then there's art, of course, and we see that with Ligon, some of that earlier work that you'll see if you go upstairs, where the art is both very queer and very black. And it's right there. But then there's art that happens, that he has done, that is neither queer and neither black, or neither people of color, you know, that you can just put your finger on, and yet it is queerly queer, and it is art by people of color, that it's at those intersection. It gives us a sense of what we might be when we've shaken up all of the rules and all of what it means to be normal. And so it serves not to normalize black or people of color and queer, but it certainly queers up and colors up normal. And in doing that, and it's perfectly positioned to do that, probably because it creates something that feels so outrageous in its normality, right? And it has incredible potential, particularly when we talk about the queering and the people of color aspect, largely because it also, if you work at the intersections of those things, you're also working at the intersections of class, you're working at all the intersections, which makes it a lovely opportunity to really make some change. And to make change, you have to create conflict. And this art creates conflict both internally to the person who's observing it, and certainly in many cases externally to systems that are in place that are designed to produce art, decide what art is, decide who an artist is. So, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so this is a great opportunity for me to actually meet Jose, whose book has been an inspiration to me, and I get to teach it. And I thought when I was asked to participate on this panel, well, which queer artists of color should I talk about? And I realized that I don't know if I really want to talk about a queer artist of color. I'll talk about a straight artist of color and talk about how queer scholars of color can queer other kinds of practices. And so I'll be showing you just two clips. This will be very, very brief. But I want to talk about this artist, Louis Gisbert, who Noah mentioned at the beginning, who I wrote about and had the opportunity to curate an exhibition of his. And as I was writing this back in 2003, around the time of the two clips I'll show you after the initial clip, I was trying to find the hook of what made sense and how what Gisbert was doing is very much like the kind of vocal otherings that Glenn Ligon does, especially in the Richard Pryor series, which hopefully we'll get to talk about as well. So John's going to help me out, but let me just set up the first. If you were watching television in 2003, you likely saw this television commercial, which I think really talks about the ways in which commercial culture, capitalist culture, actually has a way of absorbing its own critique. So then, in a sense, I'm convinced that the ad men had read Jose's book on some level, had absorbed this identifications. And you'll see what I mean when you see this 30-minute clip, which was for Citibank's identity theft protection, which now seems like a joke after 2008, right? You know, who were the real thieves back then, right? That said, we'll just show you the 30-second clip. Citibank identity theft protection.
Firewall. Like, that could stop me. Once I got her account number, I couldn't spend fast enough. 64-inch plasma screen monitor, 10 4.2 megahertz wireless routers, and $20,000 to complete my robot. My girl robot. This is going to be the best prom ever.
Introducing City Identity Theft Solutions. Free with any city card. Help getting your life back? That's using a card wisely.
All right, so the joke is obvious, right? That is to say that here we have, and of course, who can't help but love the marijuana snicker of the geek, right? But this ad campaign was supposed to make us feel safe, that Citibank was actually protecting us, and by doing this, they used this very clever trope of having a voice discontinuous with the body from which that is emitting that voice, right? And it seems to me that this is very much plays on the disidentifications that potential viewers or a viewer can have in the way that we identify with an African-American woman and her body, and the voice that clearly signifies a sort of slacker dude from Austin who wants to build his girl robot, right, so he can go to the prom. Cut to Louis Gisbert, who in 2002 produces two short videos. I'm just going to show the last minute of one that is entitled Block Watching of 2002, and then it will go right into one of the most potty-mouthed videos that you will see, I hope, that is called Can It Be That It Was All So Simple? And let me just set this up briefly, which is that the kind of work that Gisbert was doing at the time involved using cheerleaders, multi-ethnic cheerleaders, but we're only going to see two white cheerleaders in this case, who have, in a sense, used identity theft. What Gisbert is getting at is the way in which mainstream culture, white culture, has stolen the identity of hip-hop culture that goes back to African-American and Latino cultures, urban cultures of the late 70s and early 80s, and he applies this onto the bodies of these cheerleaders. And I think that's enough to just see the next clip, and then I'll just briefly end with that.
Fucking tie you to a fucking bedpost with your ass cheeks spread out and shit, right? Put a hanger on a fucking stove and let that shit sit there for like a half hour. Take it off and stick it in your ass slow like.
Yeah, I fucking lay your nuts on a fucking dresser. Just your nuts laying on a fucking dresser and bang them shits with a spike fucking back.
I'll fucking pull your fucking tongue out your fucking mouth and stab the shit with a rusty screwdriver.
I fucking hang you by your fucking dick on the fucking 12-story building out this motherfucker.
I fucking sew your asshole clothes and keep feeding you and feeding you and feeding you and feeding you.
All right, so it's all diffused with this little wink to the audience, right? You may have guessed, if you were fans of the Wu-Tang Clan, that this is the soundtrack from Enter the Wu-Tang. And so what Gisbert is doing is not unlike the kind of very volatile, potentially volatile and obscene language that Pryor used in his stand-up acts, which were much more than just using it for the profanity's sake, but actually opening up a critical space. And I think what Gisbert is doing something similar insofar as in the Block Watcher, there's the trope again, I think, of the idea that the car alarm is a kind of is speaking to a kind of identity theft. You know, we have this kind of suburban naughtiness in this kind of dance that's being done for the camera. The space, it's the green screen, which is kind of unspecified social space to which we're attaching a kind of urban, you know, our kind of disidentifications of what kind of social space do we add to something that's not there? Or in the case of the Can It Be That It Was All So Simple, the kind of violent male-on-male sexual violence that is this kind of rapping, that takes place in this kind of rapping is a kind of doubling of the kinds of homophobia, the kinds of other sexualities that are not contained in what we would assume to be these sort of innocent cheerleading bodies. And so it seemed to me that if we go to, I mean, what is so brilliant about Ligon's Pryor series, by the way, many of them are entitled Mudbone, who was one of Pryor's characters, right? Parentheses, liar, because one of, Jose mentions this in his presentation, which is that Pryor, very profound, had this great stand-up in which he says, you know, never fuck a faggot, right? Why? Because they're liars. They'll say, I won't tell, and then they tell, right? So who is Pryor actually identifying with? In other words, it's a benign use of the word faggot, because he's not saying that he hasn't had sex with someone who's gay. He doesn't deny it. But implied is the fact that the only thing that's bad about it is that you might get found out, right? And see, it seems to me that this is exactly the kind of disidentification that Jose is talking about in his book, is that we can, what does a joke do as well? Freud says also something to the effect that it removes the obstacles to our pleasure, right? Jokes remove those obstacles to our pleasure, and sometimes the very repressive and oppressive systems that are the obstacles to our pleasure can be opened up via this kind of the obscene underbelly of our various desires and identifications. So with that, I'll end there.
Well, thank you all. it's kind of amazing, like how sort of rich and varied, like each of you were able to sort of bring a lot of things around this question of like what is identification, what is disidentification, and the various ways that it functions both in terms of history and representation of the self in relationship to another. And I thought maybe before sort of going into sort of the abstract, because I think a lot of you tackled the abstract through all these very great examples, that maybe we could bring up the slides again to go back to a couple of pieces in the show. Jose, can you pass me the thing? Of course. Okay, so I'm trying to remember the order here. One second, because I don't want to reveal. One piece that we haven't talked about yet is this piece called Red Portfolio that is sort of at the end of the exhibition upstairs that Ligon made basically by photographing, from what I understand, these postcards that were sent out by the Christian Coalition that was in response to the work of Robert Mapplethorpe. And what the postcards, first of all, the thing that's very interesting about this notion of like blinders, right? Like blinders imply a certain degree of censorship and also sort of what one wants to not look at, but also in order to focus on something. These postcards, which is white text on black, were in a red envelope. And Red Portfolio is the name of this series of prints, right? So the red envelope, this sort of like bright red danger, you know, you open it up and then all you see is text. But then the text itself implies the images that that actually exist. So one of them, so on the left, the print is a photo of a man in a suit exposing himself. And to the right is the photograph of Robert Mapplethorpe's that it refers to. That was actually a part of the black book that Notes on the Margins of a Black Book includes. So then another one is a photo of a man urinating in another man's mouth. And this is the photo that refers to, which is a part of Mapplethorpe's X portfolio, which was a separate category of images. And then this one, a photo of a man with a bullwhip inserted into his rectum. And this is Mapplethorpe, also a photograph that was a part of the X portfolio.
Self-portrait,
yes.
But in the Red Book, he never shows, the photograph is not there.
Right, yeah. So this is what the point of this is. So essentially, this is the piece, right? Like, I mean, and there are many references, right? Like, one is the red envelope with a series of postcards, and that's all you know. The second level is this rephotographed series of representations of those textual representations of these, like, bad images. And so what I'm helping you to see is the origin that these things refer to. Mm-hmm. And then finally, a close-up of a man with his pinky finger inserted in his penis. So back to the overview. So what I wanted us to do is to sort of take a moment to sort of think about this, because there were two pieces that I wanted us to do some close readings of. One was this, the Red Portfolio, and the second was what Jose began to talk about, was Notes on the Margin of a Black Book. And part of the problematic, which I think the second piece talks a little bit more explicitly about, is the kind of paradoxes of identity and the performance of disidentification, as I understand it, that sort of unpacks these paradoxes, right? One of them is that these photographs, the original postcards were meant explicitly to refer to some kind of marginal position, right? Like Robert Mapplethorpe, a white, gay, photographer who sort of makes these images of things that are bad from a sort of right-wing perspective. But on the other hand, there are sort of other ways that these things could be critiqued. So I guess I was wondering if any of you had, you know, I was thinking especially with Rose, the way that you're talking about like shaking things up, right, and what that means, and the way that sort of concealing and revealing can function in the way that sort of identity is performed versus artwork, and the way that sometimes concealing can be a kind of shaking up, and sometimes revealing can be a way of shaking up. And I wonder if any of you have comments about that.
Well, I also think it's on an important level, it's also about this radical divide or rift between text and image, which is to say, which is more provocative?
Yeah.
That is, in a sense, Mapplethorpe is trafficking in the fact that we know what these images are on some level, if we know something about Mapplethorpe, right?
Yeah.
And that the disavowal of those images gives the language a much more potent and possibly obscene level than the actual image mm-hmm. that were the brunt of, or the object of all this controversy, right? And so it seems to me that also that I mean, I think part of this disidentification is also that the disavowal of an identity is just as powerful, and this is what you're saying,
yeah.
as the avowal of an identity, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not gay, right? But you are gay, or I am gay, right? By the denial, the disavowal can say something actually in a particular language environment, in a speech, as a speech act in a certain context, can be much more powerful than an actual identification. And I think this is what this piece seems to speak to as well.
And one thing I was thinking about the piece, this piece I was going to talk about, but I didn't want to go on. I tried to measure my time. The reworking of that act of censorship, right, by the Christian Coalition, whoever was sending out the red portfolios, and it isn't as clear or as easy as a kind of a defense or validation of Mapplethorpe either. It's really about adding on to the kind of powerful, disconsensus, disagreement, right? And so, you know, they, Ligon is calling attention to this act of censorship, certainly by framing it in this pristine way, but he's also interrupting Mapplethorpe's image flow as well, right? And deciding to shut those down in relationship to the piece as well. So it's doing this double work, which I think is really interesting, this kind of two-pronged kind of intervention, mm-hmm. you know, both in relationship to what Mapplethorpe, his visual lexicon, and how it functioned with the explicit and also the act of censorship that was layered onto him, right?
I also think that he makes these pieces become his voice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we hear them in his voice because it's his work.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and I think that the responses to the Mapplethorpe Black Book, is that piece is about those responses. The Black Book is just there to, so you know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But those voices are the voices that are important in that piece, not Mapplethorpe's.
Right.
Okay, so then maybe it would be helpful to take a closer look at Notes on the Margins of the Black Book, which I think there's so many levels of controversy that are sort of layered into this image. I mean, one was that the piece was originally shown at the 1993 Whitney Biennial, which was like legendary for it being about like sort of identity politics, and you know, those who hated it for that reason and those who loved it for that reason. And so in and of itself, the piece sort of was a part of this enormous act of discourse around, you know, ideas of minoritarian identity already. But then the piece itself was also about and directly engaging sort of discourse around these kinds of contradictions. So Like, one thing, for instance, that Jose talks about in his book is that there were a number of people who had really had a very negative reaction originally to Mapplethorpe's Black Books, basically thinking that it was potentially racist, that it was sort of aesthetically and racially objectifying the bodies of the men that were depicted in these images. And even Ligon in the catalog sort of is quoted as saying, like, I was looking through this book and asking myself, like, is this racist? Like, he's sort of looking at the book and asking it if it is. So he literally takes pages from the book and then basically constructs a series of questions and discourses around it, right? They don't necessarily answer it in one way or the other. So one attack, for instance, was by Coben and Mercer and Isaac Julian, who had written this essay in 1987 that was like making the argument essentially that it was objectifying in that way. But then later, sort of after the kind of right wing attacks against Mapplethorpe
and the NEA
and the all of the NEA, I mean, there's so much of the culture wars that is implicit in this piece, right? Like something that it's amazing to me that I think some people have forgotten actually that the culture wars ever existed. But Mapplethorpe was a part of this enormous controversy within the United States. There were a number of things. One is that Jesse Helms had basically used him as an example and used these specific images that were the Christian Coalition had referred to in the Red Envelope as the reason why artists should not get funding any longer through the National Endowment for the Arts. So the NEA was cut severely in relationship to that, to Mapplethorpe's work. Basically there's this paradox, right? Like there's this kind of like right-wing attack on the book and then this sort of progressive attack on the book and Mapplethorpe's work. And that prompted, Jose, you had mentioned that that Mercer and Julian had sort of then kind of eased their criticism, sort of realizing that that it had a different place. So I guess I'm wondering if we can if you guys would be interested in sort of slowing down and thinking about this piece in general and thinking about how you see it as sort of reflecting on some of these paradoxes. Like, do you think that it comes down on within one side of a spectrum, or is it simply raising a set of questions?
I think that one of the things that's interesting to me about this piece is that it's a dialogue within a dialogue within a dialogue. And it makes me want to talk back to it, so which moves it forward. This is a piece in itself, but the piece is of what folks had to say about the piece, and so what's interesting to me about that dialogue within a dialogue within a dialogue. Is that it creates then all of these conflicts to some degree with no answers. It doesn't attempt to create or to make any answers. In my opinion, what it does is that it furthers this peace and dialogue. So you can't see this without being in dialogue with each of the individual quotes. You can't see it without being in dialogue with the pictures, both individually and as a group. And I'm being serious when I say I want to actually talk back to it. I want to talk back to the whole piece. I want to talk back to the people who are quoted there. And I just saw it today. I've never seen it before. It's quite magnificent, in that art that talks about itself, talks about other art that talks about itself, that makes you want to talk about it, is pretty profound. Right? That's pretty profound.
What do you want to say?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
I want to say different things at different places. And some places I want to ask questions, both of the models, mm-hmm. and of oftentimes of the people who are in the quotes, and then of Ligon as well. I want to know why those quotes there. But I also want to say, why do all those men have such big dicks? is that not something I should say here?
If not here, where?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And you know, what's the meaning of that? And how do the people who are in the quotes, you know, sometimes they notice and sometimes they didn't seem to, right? And anyway.
And just to echo something that Annette said, you can't look at this work without inhabiting, in a sense, Glenn Ligon's body, right? You know that mm-hmm. he looks at these pictures thoughtfully, mm-hmm. that he finds them compelling, that they're titillating, yet they're also disturbing. And the kind of the network of communications, of friends that opens up of, you know, when did he jot down that particular quote? Mm-hmm. I know you love jotting down citations as well, and that mm-hmm. that it becomes a kind of biography, a second level biography of Glenn Ligon himself, right? And yeah. that seems to me that it's a kind of orchestra of voices mm-hmm. that are also extensions of mm-hmm. his own voice.
And an artifact of an artifact, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. of maybe an artifact.
So while we were upstairs just now, we were saying, so those are actually pages from the book, just deconstructed and then framed in those little black frames.
As far as I understand.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
I mean, maybe to say, like, anecdotally, when I saw that in 1993, I was working on finishing my dissertation, and there was the glossolalia of words and the quotes. I felt like I was kind of in my dissertation. it kind of embodied a lot of work that a lot of us were doing at that moment, trying to think about race and sexuality. And so it's a kind of living extension of a kind of active process that so many people were engaged in. And you know, I think, Rose, when you said you were very succinct and I think right on point when you said there's no transformation without conflict, right, without disagreement, right? And I think that kind of the disagreements in the quotations, right, the different mm-hmm. kind of perspectives on it really are what the piece is about, as I understand it. In psychoanalysis, the term ambivalence isn't like just, you know, our everyday, like, oh, I'm kind of ambivalent about that. It's not wishy-washy. Ambivalence is really between love and hate. And I think that's what this piece is about. It is about ambivalence. It's about Ligon's love of these images and his hatred mm-hmm. of these images, right? And they're both represented through that voice of his. It is like Annette said, his own voice through citation, mm-hmm. right? And that's the dialogue I hear. I hear a dialogue in his own head that is between love and hate, and that's what's being worked through.
So speaking about ambivalence in relationship to dialogue, I, on the one hand, would like us to continue having this conversation, but on the other hand, I think it would be great to be able to hear from some folks in the audience with any questions or comments that you might have. So maybe if we could get the lights and then see if anyone has anything. Yeah.
Anyone has a question?
I was just thinking about what you all were just talking about Ligon's voice in this piece, and I don't know, from this person, just for having seen the piece today myself, I also think that there's a way in which Ligon's gone to some effort to erase his own voice from the piece. They're not his photographs, it's not handwritten, it's, you know, it's typographical. And it's sort of an interesting way to actually remove the artist from the installation as well. I was also struck by the fact that, and I don't know, maybe Andrea can tell us more, that the frame quotes are quite deliberately not in step with the photographs, and they actually look like they're kind of rotating past the photographs in a way, especially in the corner installation. So there's a way in which the quote, the piece is also about how the quotes don't actually engage with the photographs.
photographs in some way, or they or words and images are maybe never commensurate. I don't know. Do you feel like that? Convince me that Ligon's present here, I guess, is one of the things that I'm asking. Like, where is his voice? Is it in the? It's not even in the selection of images, because it's all the images.
But it is in the selection of text, right?
Yeah,
he does come up in the text.
I mean, in a sense, it seems to me that became a very appealing mode, and it still is, for me at least. And you were, Annette, we're talking about, what is her name?
Alexis.
Alexis, exactly. Alexis's work, in which, you know, we are all built on citations, visible or otherwise, right? That basically we're just reiterations of other citations, and in a sense, where's the original, where's the copy? It seems to me that's one way that he's creating a presence, but he's also banking on the fact that your body is in front of it, and so that your body as a spectator is a placeholder for his. And I couldn't help but notice when I was in the gallery space, like who spends much, you know, who spends time looking at the big dicks, who spends time looking at the text. I mean, because it is about, you know, watching that is looking, being looked at, right?
Yeah, if he was attempting to hide, he was hiding behind a glass wall. in that, it's a piece. It's not individual photographs and individual quotes. It's a piece that compels you to at least on some level. You know, when you walk into the room, it's all there. And so you see it in small snatches or big pieces, or you read the quote, but it's still a piece. And so it's his piece, but it's for me it's a bit like a collage, you know, where you might find the shells on the beach and add some paper and add some other things. But it's still you. You're still present in there, even when you're using other work.
And I think too that although there isn't a photograph of Glenn on the wall, there are photographs of black men. He's a black man, so he could identify with any of those men. Mm-hmm. And as you were just speaking, it just makes me think of this. May not be related at all, but the I am Trayvon Martin thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's all those guys, and.
He's also shaking up things by everyone, not knowing who, what gender, what race, what sexual identification is going to be in his place, too. So it's, you know, there's an interesting way in which he's mixing things up, even as you were talking about in other words in this.
There's only one moment where you realize that you become a participant in his becoming, right? Because he's conceived of this piece, and he says, oh, I've got to get permission from the Mapplethorpe Trust. Right. And so he clearly wrote a letter to the trust, and they wrote back, "Dear Mr. Ligon, we give you permission to use these images, right?" Which is a very kind of it interpolates both the spectator and Ligon in this text text image piece quite.
Yeah,
quite.
And he comes into it again at a different moment when I think it's one of his friends, either Lyle Ashton Harris or Thomas Harris or Gary Simmons, one of them basically says, so you're basically killing the great white master.
That's right.
And he's commenting on what Ligon's doing in this project, or what he thinks Ligon is doing, right? So he comes in as a you, right?
And he also, there's a diary entry where he says, I put the black book down and danced the night away.
Danced with
Lyle.
Right, yeah. Danced with Lyle, yes. Yeah.
And it's diary and it had a date.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that there's like two sort of theoretical territories that overlaps. One is sort of like the queering of identity formation and identity position, and the other is like an issue of like artistic authorship, right? Like, so where is the artist's voice? Is it in a fixed place? Is there one author that produces one thing that then is a claim to that originating author? You know, I think that there's a relationship between like the way that we sort of think of identity as being fluid and being sort of mirrored back and forth, and the way that we think about how, like, you know, artistic authorship can work. And I think that piece, and I think probably all of his work, is about the relationship between those two dynamics.
Yeah.
I think it's also about text and image not lining up, and how you're battling between what you're seeing visually and what you're reading, and how the text do not necessarily go with the image right above. You know, that was obviously very intentional on his part. And all of his work kind of does that. You know, we have this messy stenciled text over this creamy background, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And he does it here in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, and that's what kind of messes you up, because you go to it and it's kind of the presentation of the frames and the way it's organized. You think it's like a conceptual piece. Like, is it like a Kossuth, or what is it? And then the fact that the quotes don't help define or kind of play out different meanings in the photographs, but kind of conflate them and make them, that's what's so... It kind of takes it to another level in a way.
Mm-hmm. It's more Kossuth.
The other part, or another part, of the use of these images and the use of the texts that were used by the Christian Coalition, or whatever entity that really was, is that all of the artists who were a big part of the fight against the NEA in the 80s were people who were either photographers or performance artists, so that they were actually, it was something that was really happening. It was a photograph of like an actual person or an actual people, or it was an event that someone was doing on stage or talking about on stage, so that it was real. It wasn't a painting, it wasn't a poem, it wasn't a song. It was something that was really happening. And in the texts that are in the Red portfolio, it's what the Christian Coalition chose to interpret those mm-hmm. actual things, or those documentations of actual things.
Mm-hmm.
And another aspect of this, too, is that while Glenn Ligon was able to get permission from the Mapplethorpe Foundation, one of the strong counter moves during the culture wars during the 80s was that David Wojnarowicz was able to sue the Reverend Wildman, which from whatever organization he was, and successfully stop him from using excerpts of his own images in propaganda against his work. And that he won that lawsuit. He didn't win like huge money, but his action was that, like, these images are my images, and like he can't use them to like, you know, try to combat what I'm trying to do. So there's a lot of different layers from what was happening at those points that get mirrored and have a lot of resonance in how Glenn Ligon is using those images now in these pieces.
I'll just add, that's a great point, and it is about the body, right? It's about the way the body gets put up front, right? In Holly Hughes and Karen Finley, Tim Miller, the artists who were the performance artists who were censored, and in the photography itself, it's about a real body being put out there. That was the lightning rod for all of this. Yes, that's a really good point.
Harold.
Yeah.
Thank you. And not to take the attention away from the Ligon work, because I'm definitely a Ligon fanatic, but my question is probably more of the theory of disidentification. And first, thank you for the book. It's certainly helped me kind of put what I thought I knew about myself and was wondering about in some kind of context. My question is, personally, and you bring this up kind of in a quote in the book, and I'm taking a quote out of context, just so you know, or maybe using half of it, where it talks about identity being a site of struggle. I can deal with that. And one of the things I'm struggling with in terms of identity is masculinity. And I went through this whole thing of rejecting masculinity. Then I started reading a book. It's like, oh, am I disidentifying with masculinity? And it's interesting. So now, but you know, I had this epiphany, but maybe I'm post-masculinity or post-masculinity. And so, but I'm interested in how, you know, disidentifying or maybe being post-something could work together, or maybe not. I want to know if I'm post-masculine.
Yes.
All of the above.
Right.
I don't know you well enough. But let me venture. Thank you. I'm happy that the book is useful and helpful to you. That's great. And it helps you think about stuff, because that's what I always wanted it to do. I would say that, you know, masculinity, like any form, you know, I mean, there's a way in which masculinity was getting talked about at the time that I wrote that book, and there was like kind of like a kind of new agey Robert Bly kind of discourse on masculinity that was really
guy I was super allergic to, so it was never a term that I worked with at the time. But I think now, I think, you know, there's different ways to think about masculinity and the way it can be reworked, right? I mean, an important book that came out a few years, I guess 10 years ago now, is Judith Halberstam's Female Masculinity, where she talked about how biological gender is no longer the anchoring kind of factor, right? And we can think about the ways in which all sorts of us carry and rework and repurpose both femininity and masculinity in relationship to our bodies that don't align with something like biology or, you know, the list of things that are made up that Rose shared with us, like race, etc., right? That we don't have to kind of succumb to the kind of the weight of these normative ideas about what masculinity or femininity might be, and whatever's in or beside those terms as well, right? So yeah, I would say you can work with it, right?
Yep.
One of the series in the show that I think that for me really ties into what you've been saying about this identity is the Runaway Slave series. And I'd be really curious to hear your comments about that, because it's such a wonder. It seems subtle in a way, but it's just supercharged in terms of interpretation of identity and so forth.
No, it's an amazing piece, and I did also want to talk about that. I mean, I only used half my slides, but you know that series, especially the, you know, Ligon became really invested in the William Box Brown story about the slave who mailed himself to freedom and then reenacted it on the stage, right, and made a performance out of it, and so those boxes and the sonic kind of output they have, kind of hinting at another life, another world inside of them, like, you know, a black life world that's suggested by, you know, Billie Holiday or KRS-One or whoever is coming out of those boxes is so evocative and powerful. And then the actual kind of the kind of front pieces, the typographical, the very delicate, elegant typographical work that is mimicking the style of those manuscripts, those texts is I think really ingenious. But he again mixes, there's a kind of temporal work that's happening. It's about the present and the past. So, you know, one is about the Snow Queen, which is a term that came into existence around the 70s and the 80s, around black men who were mostly interested in white men. And there's a citation from Hilton Alls, who we know today from The New Yorker, but at the time was writing really interesting essays about those issues. And so there's a certain kind of collage across time that happens in those pieces, which I think is also the kind of pulling from different sources that I think is the kind of practice discontinuity, which I'm describing as disidentification.
I think about that piece that he brings slavery into the conversation only in order to talk about freedom, you mm-hmm. know, and that they're hilariously mm-hmm. funny.
There's also the notion that in order for disidentification to occur, you have to become aware. Well, you are aware of what's outside of your mm-hmm. your sight. That it's not as if you don't know it's there. Mm-hmm. And that particular piece uses the visible and the invisible, mm-hmm. The exposed and the unexposed, in a way that you have totally available to you what you see and hear. But you also have available to you, literally in terms of the box, what's not available mm-hmm. to you, which That didn't make a whole lot of sense, but I know what it means. I know exactly what I'm talking about.
Here's a question up here.
Yeah.
Kind of continue on Harold's trajectory of the idea of post and what you guys think about Glenn Ligon along with Thelma Golden being some of the instigators of the post-black, you know, chaos phenomena, whatever, and how that filters into other, you know, the queer community, other communities of color, etc.
I don't know what she said.
She's talking about post-black. Do you have some ideas about that?
I can go first.
Well, I mean, you know, I think, I don't know if anyone's really invested in that term anymore. I think, you know, it was a provocation, but I don't think it really...
It didn't stick.
It didn't stick.
Is it the New Yorker this week, you know, with, I think, Jerry Saltz and whoever, you know, how to be a successful artist, be post-black from Chicago.
Right. You know, oh, yeah. Talking about the SJWs.
Yeah. By the time it trickles down to Jerry Saltz, you know, it's pretty dead. You know, it stops being relevant. You know, I mean, it really does.
The Facebook community and the Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. It is part of, like, of a debate, of a public kind of debate. And, you know, and I'm thinking of that guy Chicago who basically, God, what's his name? The literary theorist who announced that black literature was over. I'm forgetting his name. It's escaping me. And, you know, I don't think that, I disagree with it. I think there, you know, again, we can talk about the ways in which, you know, race is constructed. Race is not a real thing, but at the same time, it impacts us, mm-hmm. right? It we feel it every day as soon as we kind of enter the world. So, you know, real or not real, it touches us all the time. So I never, you know, it was hard for me to even kind of take that discourse seriously. I don't know.
Yeah, I think... I don't think we've dealt with blackness, really. And so we can't be post-black. Mm. And therefore, we can't be post-black. Yeah. But I was as we were talking earlier before this panel, Alexis Gumbs is reading Black Feminist, and you know she's seeing it with brand new eyes. And I read that stuff 20 years ago, and she's so pumped about it. You know, like it's brand new information. Which makes me really pumped about it, you know, because it's still really, you know, fertile. And so, you know, that can't be possible if post-black is actually real, you know. It's made up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi.
On those lines, I just wanted to say I feel like being post-black, being post-gay is optimistic, but it's also like being post-Catholic. I grew up Catholic, and even though I reject the church now, you know, it's something that sticks with you like an ethnicity. And so, yeah, like, given that we are of the century, we cannot, say, supersede this. We can work at it, but that it is something that we have to acknowledge on a regular basis.
I think it's beyond optimistic. It's actually opportunistic. To some large degree, sure. Because it's not this notion and the concept is not based on any kind of cross identification or disidentification where we all just get to be what and whoever we want to be and we're exist as equals. It really is strategic, and I think malevolent. In its focus, and an attempt to other in a particular different kind of way, and so I think it's particularly dangerous, and that we are so far from the optimistic place that you go to that I can't even get there in the interim, and think that the conversation about post-black. Is something that we have to be really careful about, and then I do believe that it's particularly dangerous because I believe that it's an attempt to make invisible that which is still very much an active force and an active force of oppression, frankly. And did I speak too strongly about that?
I actually think it is optimistic to deal with blackness and gayness and those things in themselves. That's also optimistic.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it lands in that space that you were talking about ambivalence, right? And, you know, looking at his work again, I can see how he's sort of the godfather of this idea of post-blackness. And because I took it to mean, or in what they actually stated in the, you know, freestyle catalog, was it's this idea of the schizophrenia of artists of color who, like, are clearly working with a certain aesthetic, clearly working on certain topics, but don't want to be necessarily identified or pigeonholed as such. Rather than the idea of just being past blackness, you know? Mm-hmm. So I feel like it fits into that space,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
That, you know, schizophrenic space that a lot of people grapple with when they're dealing with these intersections.
No, I mean, there's something about identity that's very coercive, right? That, you know, identity isn't just something that we wake up in the morning and choose, like you're saying, like, oh, I'm going to try on blackness today. But it's something that, you know, is compulsory in relationship to the law, in relationship to the ways in which we are perceived and classified in the world, right? It's nothing that we can choose. So I understand the kind of provocation of suggesting something is post-black, but I think it's merely that, a provocation, because I think, you know, all that work still is working with and working through blackness, right? Like you said, we're not over blackness, right? Blackness is still, you know, an ongoing project. You know, it is, you know, and I'm interested in thinking of thinking about, you know, what a black radical tradition is of resistance and insurrection, and how that's also being indexed here. It isn't just about wanting to shed it, but it's actually about kind of also perpetuating it as well.
Okay, this will be the last one.
So, thinking about pre and post is really offensive in this way. Because first, the only way we could talk about me is by talking about not you. In other words, it was me not being who they are. So that's pre. So before, it was, I'm not you, and what's wrong with that? The reason why post is so awful is because now it's just another way of asking me not to be me, except in another way. So we're done. We're all of a sudden we're done with being me, and I don't remember being me. What I really love about this is that perhaps it starts a conversation and perhaps some activity where I can be me in my own space without regard to who anybody else might be in relationship with me. So finally, we might be able to talk about my own identity as me without pre or post or not.
That sounds like a performance piece.
I want to say one more thing about identity.
Okay, please do.
I think that when, like, based on your me conversation, you're also, when you're trying to figure out who you are, you're looking at the whole world and trying to see, you know, where you fit into a real long continuum of stuff that's been going on before, so you don't feel like you dropped out of the sky. You know, and if you're a person of color and you're queer and lots of other things, and you just base your information pool on stuff you learn at school, say, you could actually feel like you dropped out of the sky. And it's really important to find yourself in a context, or to create a context, or to, you know, like, look around and see if you can place yourself somewhere, so that you don't feel that way.
And it doesn't exclude also what others make of you. And I think that's also the piece. It's not just what you make of yourself. It's kind of what the world and what the system and what the culture makes of you that impacts that. And in terms of thinking about blackness in the post, until the world, till our culture, till America, Glenn Ligon, stops making of people of color in whatever way that's constituted and thought of, then it's possible for us, all of us, to also not in that not be in that coerced in terms of the way that identity is formed, identification.
Okay, well, thank you all very much, and thanks to all the panelists.
Thank you.